Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. In this hour, a special presentation in partnership with the Daily Yonder, detailing how Galax, Virginia fought back when opioids came to town. First, though, a new film that really gets down into the minute-by-minute struggle to shake off a raging addiction to the opioids that flooded towns and rural communities of central Appalachia. Titled Hazard, it stars Alex Rowe and Sosie Bacon, daughter of Kevin, with a cast of extras drawn from drug rehab programs in the region. With us now is the film's director, Eddie Menser. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Eddie.
Thank you very much for having me.
And so I gave just the very briefest description of the story behind your film, but if you would, tell us more.
I would like to say one clarification. Hazard is a story about opioid addiction in Appalachia, central Appalachia, not necessarily eastern Kentucky at all. We use the name Hazard because that's where I first did my research, and the name Hazard is a very proper name for the movie, but it's not about Perry County Hazard. It's more about central Appalachia as a whole.
So the town where it takes place could be any town in central Appalachia.
It certainly is any town in central Appalachia. If Hazard didn't have a poignant name called Hazard, it wouldn't be about it, but it's not primarily about Perry County necessarily. Even though my best friend is from there, it's where the story originated. I did my research there, but I also did my research all over central Appalachia. I'm from West Virginia, and the opioid epidemic has hit West Virginia just as much. And my stories are about Appalachia, not about Hazard, Perry County, Eastern Kentucky.
Okay, that's a really important clarification. I'm glad you made it. So if you would, give us a little bit of a description of the story that's told in Hazard.
Like all my stories, they're told really from a first-person point of view. So Hazard is about a young couple struggling with addiction, and they want to change their lives for the better, and time's running out. They're both in their early 30s. They're not kids anymore, and things have hit the fan, so to speak. Will is at the end of his road where addiction is going to take he and his family off the map for good in prison, or it could be death, or it could just be, you know, the end of the road for him. So he's at that decision to go back into rehab or just end the game altogether, so to speak. So really it's about hopefully seeing light at the end of the tunnel in the darkest of your times.
Tell us a little bit about your background and what brought you to this story.
So I'm originally from West Virginia. And I'm an Appalachian filmmaker. All of my movies are about Appalachia. And my goal with the stories that I tell in general are just to tell stories that show, even if they're dark stories such as this, or my previous movie was about a coal mine disaster, I want people on the outside looking in to see us as humans and not just a stereotypical story that is in Time Magazine or USA Today. So the goal with it is to, like, even if someone's struggling in Los Angeles, California, or New York City with addiction, they can look, watch a story like this, see somebody like Will, and know that they're very much the same type of person and not a stereotype.
So how did you cast the film? I know that, of course, the leading roles are by professional actors. Seems like there might be a lot of extras there from the area. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was amazing. So we were fortunate, like, as far as the locals, we filmed this in Harlan County, which is right next to Perry County Hazard. And we filmed it there because I'm trying to make probably one or two movies down the road based off that song, Never Leave Harlan Alive. So I was like, if I'm going to try to go make the movie Never Leave Harlan Alive, let's just get our boots into Harlan now. And I met a producer, Gil Holland. His father was from Harlan. He owns the Harlan Brew Company, and he sent me to Harlan. And I was like, this is perfect. So we were fortunate enough to work with Lydia's Place, which is ARC. It's a recovery network. And Alex Rowe, our lead, got to come in and work with Lydia's Place. And we got to meet, you know, 24 people who were in recovery. And they took Alex. They let him sit in NA meetings. They took him out. They worked with him. And they were the extras in the movie. So a lot of the people who are in recovery, who you see in the movie, like, those are real people in recovery who helped us behind the camera and in front of the camera. So it was important to let them sort of take a piece of this, their past that they're trying to get past of their past, and do something positive. And that was helping us make this film. So, yeah.
Alex Rowe is actually a British actor. And as I'm sure you know, people in our region are pretty sensitive about being portrayed by outsiders. We have clips, first from an interview with Alex about his role in the film Forever My Girl, a previous film that he was in, and how he adopted a Southern American accent for that. And that's followed by a clip of Alex in this role of Will from Hazard. Let's listen to them back to back.
We had a couple of sessions with a dialect coach who helped us pick out certain sounds. But yeah, it was just kind of maybe 2 one-hour sessions. And then luckily our director's from Louisiana too. So if there was anything that needed to be tweaked a little bit, she could give us advice. But we grow up with so much American TV back home and American movies, so we've heard all of these accents a lot of times, whereas you guys only really hear British accents when awkward Brits like me come and talk on the telly.
Look, I want to know what's going to happen to Sarah. I gave her the drugs, okay? Just arrest me, man. John, there's got to be something you can do.
I've seen the film, and I think that Will is incredibly plausible in that role. But did Alex have to do further study to get closer to the pretty distinctive Appalachian Kentucky accent?
So that clip you played from Forever My Girl, I've never heard, but we did the polar opposite. Alex came to Harlan County a month before filming started, and he... literally, I would see him once or twice, 3 times a week, and he hung out with people from the region and hung out with people who were in recovery and learned their accent to the best of his ability. But that gentleman came from California and spent a month in Harlan County just learning the dialect and learning about addiction, just to portray them with as much honesty as possible.
I think we're going to see more of Alex Rowe, aren't we? he's pretty
great. He's an amazing actor, and it's not like this was a big-budget Hollywood movie where he needed or he had to do that. Like, he did that out of his own heart and his own truthfulness to tell the story.
And that's a person who believes in their craft. So who wrote the screenplay?
I did.
You did. Okay, you did that, and you directed.
Yes, sir, and I produced it, and... probably washed people's clothes or something
done. And the score is really interesting too. Who did that?
Thank you. His name is Mauricio Yazzigi. We've made 3 movies together now. He's based in Los Angeles. He's actually from Chile, but he understands the type of, he understands my movies. So he you know, has the music, but all of the actual music that is in the movie is all Appalachian musicians from the region.
Okay, now the film opens in New York on January 31st and in Los Angeles, February 7th. And some in our listening area may cringe when they hear that. There's a lot of concern among Appalachians, as you know, about how they're portrayed to the rest of the world. We all know about those stereotypes. How do you address those concerns?
You know, my filmmaking career is addressing those stereotypes. So I am that stereotype. I am that West Virginia person that had moved to Los Angeles for 15 years of his life and was stereotyped. And the movies that I make are about ending those stereotypes. So I fully understand that people from Hazard could be weary of the project. And that's why we're going there on the 9th to do a community screening to put them at ease. But I am fully aware of how people's opinions can be about this story.
To change the subject a little bit, Kentucky is becoming known for having some pretty incredible film incentives, production incentives. Were you able to take advantage of those?
We absolutely did. And that's why I went to Kentucky for this one. I was preparing this movie to film in the state of Georgia because they have a tax credit. And at the time, Kentucky did not have a tax credit. And that's when our executive producer, Gil Holland, contacted me and said, Kentucky's tax credit is back. There's no way you're making this movie outside of Kentucky. And he sent me to Harlan County.
Well, who on the ground in Harlan County
ought to be credited for helping make this happen. Did you have some folks there that helped you out?
Yes, sir, I did. So just so you know, when you talk about being weary of outsiders, we filmed this in July of 2022. And I believe I started going there in December of 21 just to meet the people and for them to accept me. So it took me 6-7 months to be able to even film there. But the magistrate, Paul Browning, he's our saving grace in the Tri-City area of Harlan County. If it wasn't for Paul, he's the magistrate there in the Harlan Economic Development. That's it. They met me. They knew that I wasn't doing anything in vain. And once I broke through that first layer of trepidation, they opened up their hearts.
Well, Eddie, what sort of impact or what kind of outcome are you hoping for here?
The outcome that I desire is for people on the outside looking in to see that addiction is addiction and we're just not people from Appalachia who you can stereotype. That what happened to Appalachia happened to everybody, you know, all over, and that we're all the same people in this world. And there's so much separation in our world today as it is. And I'm just hoping to bridge that gap slightly, just to be like we're all one human, we're all one soul.
That's Eddie Mencer, director of the new film Hazard. It's about the struggle in a central Appalachian town to break free from opioid addiction. It's premiering in theaters across the region. And Mencer will be on hand to take questions after a screening of the film at the Movie Tavern at Brandon Crossing on January 17th. Thanks so much and good luck with this, Eddie.
Thank you so much, sir. I appreciate it.
Hazard is a depiction of the Appalachian struggle against addiction. Now the Real Thing, presented in partnership with The Daily Yonder. On the rebound, stories from Recovery Court with host Sarah June Jacebo.
It's torment is what it is. It's a tug of war that you don't feel like you can win.
I was a mental health worker and got strung out on heroin, pills, and meth and lost everything.
I was selling dope at 11, 12 years old.
I started smoking marijuana when I was 11 years old. I was doing pills. I started doing methamphetamine when I was about 18 years old.
Didn't really start like using drugs, marijuana and stuff like that till I was about 13. When I started using meth, I was around 17, 18 years old.
I started smoking pot when I was about 12. And by 13, I had done used meth, and or it wasn't meth then, it was crank and cocaine.
I look at myself in the mirror a lot, and I don't fully recognize the person that's standing there. But I don't miss the old me because she ended up where she did in all that trouble and ended up hurting her family and her son. I don't fully know the person I am now, but I'm excited to learn.
Drug culture has always existed in my immediate community. I steered clear of drugs, but I couldn't avoid the consequences of it. My name is Sarah June, and I'm from Couchiching County, Minnesota, and Winnesheik County, Iowa. Growing up, my dad was a Lutheran pastor for rural churches. My earliest years were spent on the Canadian border in Minnesota's North Woods. And then in 1975, when my dad took an appointment to be closer to his parents, we moved to farm country in Northeast Iowa. One of the things I loved to do when I was a kid was pull out a tape recorder and record elders telling their stories about the old days. And when I left home at 18, I kept recording stories as a hobby. Eventually, it became part of my work as a freelance writer. And when I came across the Daily Yonder in 2022, I realized that maybe they'd be interested in some of my work. So I've been contributing to the Yonder for a couple years now. The same year I began writing for the Daily Yonder, my husband and I relocated to Southwest Virginia to a little town called Galax. Galax is named after a native plant that grows here in the Blue Ridge Mountains. The town of around 6,000 is adorable. Galax has a long history with old-time country and bluegrass music. There's an amazing old fiddlers competition here that's taken place every year for nearly 90 years. And we are home to a trailhead for a beautiful wooded bike trail connecting with the Appalachian Trail. But when I got here, I kept coming across people in public who were overdosing on drugs. One time, there was a guy just standing in the street in front of our house, and he couldn't open his eyes or talk. And then there was a guy laying beside the road on the way to the hospital. And another time, there were two men sitting in an idling car at the grocery store. Their eyes were barely open, and both of them were moving their hands in space in front of their faces. For context, at one point years ago, Galax was number 4 in the nation per capita where pharmacies pumped millions of prescription opioids into the region. Galax was also the only town with a hospital that served thousands of rural families who needed help for loved ones with addiction. And the town became a location for an inpatient rehabilitation program that serves people mostly from Virginia's metro areas. So for the size of this little country town, they've been saddled with a heavy burden, and they rose to the challenge. This area must be recognized for everything they've done over the years to help friends, families, and neighbors recover from drug addiction. They've moved mountains on a shoestring budget to provide support, police, and interventions that respond to the snowballing drug crisis. And only now is Galax beginning to receive funds from the Sackler settlement. That's part of a $6 billion payout from the owners of Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin, to families and states. One day, we had a phone call from back home in Wisconsin. My husband's first cousin died from fentanyl. He was an electrician and a father of 3. We knew he'd struggled with substance use, but this last time, he'd received a deadlier mix of fentanyl. Losing someone in our family to a drug overdose prompted me to want to do more to tell the story of what goes on with addiction and substance use disorder, especially in rural and small-town places. I got trained to administer Narcan, and I keep a dose with me in case I come across someone who's passed out. I also learned about 2 judges in my district who were trying something new. After decades of the crippling effects of drug activity and people with repeat offenses, Judges Lee Harrell and Brett Giesler decided to step back a bit from the lock-em-up approach. They established a drug court alternative to incarceration, and Judge Harrell is quick to point out that it's no longer called a drug court in Virginia. It's now called recovery court. Recovery courts aren't available in every judicial district in the U.S., but if a judge decides to add one to their courtroom, it offers an alternative to incarceration for people facing drug charges. These courts were an innovation that responded to the 1980s crack epidemic that plagued predominantly urban, working-class African-American communities. With the meteoric rise of policing drugs during the 1970s, courtrooms began to see high numbers of repeat drug offenses. So in the 1980s, some judges in Florida decided to provide a legal way for people to begin recovery from addiction instead of sending them to prison. And the drug court model still sets an example for ways to handle drug offenses today. Their requirements will vary depending on what districts decide to prioritize. In this recovery court program in Southwest Virginia, Giesler and Harrell required daily reporting, location tracking, drug and alcohol screening and testing. This program also offers substance use treatment, psychological services, mandatory community service, and employment requirements. If the participant successfully fulfills all of these requirements, the ideal outcome is a full dismissal of the pending charges. Giesler and Harrell also did something completely innovative and the first of its kind in the nation. With the expertise of Walter Midkiff, a local athletic trainer, The judges added a weekly fitness requirement to their recovery court regimen, and the judges themselves exercise alongside the people matriculating through their program. And it's making an impact. Judges and staff are noticing repeat drug offense numbers are going down. Individuals are having more success at getting their lives back on track because physical fitness seems to be boosting their recovery with substance use disorder. Working out every week seems to help a body's chemistry to reset and challenge addiction. Over the past year, I sat down with several folks who are part of this recovery court. They told me their stories and how this program has impacted them. They also talked about the ways drug culture affects our communities. When I reported on Southwest Virginia's recovery court and fitness programs for the Daily Yonder, I knew that the articles I wrote didn't focus on what people going through the program were experiencing. So I wanted to find a way for this group to tell their stories in their own words without me getting in the way. I decided to go back to what I'd been doing since I was a kid. I invited them to talk into a microphone and tell me what was important to them, what they wanted people to know about their lives. The voices you heard at the top of this episode were some of the participants of the Recovery Court program. I also had the chance to be a part of a conversation between a woman named Melissa and Judge Harrell as they discussed her graduation.
You're Melissa, and you are a defendant in my court. And I guess you're here today to have your charges dismissed because you completed the recovery court program. Is all of that correct?
Yes.
When did you come in? I mean, like, for when did you come in the first time? Because we go back. We go back at least 3 years.
2018.
Okay. All right. So we're going on, that's almost 6 years.
Yes.
I've been fooling with you. Okay.
We've been seeing each other for 6 years and it did not start
That's
well.
That's like my longest relationship.
Mine too. And I have 3 ex-husbands. Okay.
Melissa and Judge Harrell discussed her criminal record, where they reflected on how she continued to fail out of each program they put her in, violate her probation, and even escape from court and went on the run.
And I said, nope, not today. No, they're not getting me today.
No. It was the slowest escape I've ever seen. I mean, she was going about 4 miles an hour.
I just have this image of like this slow motion mic drop. Like, yeah. I'm out of here.
We made eye contact.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yeah. We made eye contact. I saw her go by.
Yeah. I was expecting to get pulled over going down the road. I didn't think I'd make it that far. But it was...
So then you pick up. What happens after that?
I go on the run for 6 months, and I catch 2 distribution charges while I'm on the run. So.
Oh, yeah. Man.
Yeah.
Finally, Melissa got into the recovery court program.
Well, I mean, it's kind of amazing you got recovery court. Yes. You really owe that to the prosecutor, Brandon Boyles, because, you know, I told you when he came to us at our group meeting, our team meeting for recovery court and brought your name up. I mean, I think I just started laughing. I'm like, are you kidding me? That gal, she's been through here like for years and she bombs everything. We're not going to bring her into this. There's no way. And he's like, yeah.
Melissa's recovery court experience helped her get clean, but also deeply impacted Judge Harrell. They discussed how they both have grown together over the years.
Did you want to do recovery court?
Were you in a
mindset that you wanted this?
Yes. I was done. I wanted the structure. I knew that was the only way I was going to get clean. Because if he would have given me my jail time, I would have just stayed in jail and got right back out and went right back to it. I wanted the structure. I wanted the meetings. I wanted the help.
And when you got into recovery court, did you take it seriously from day one?
Yes. I got wrote up at my job for attendance and for leaving early to go to classes. I put 100, I actually put 200% into my recovery.
She did.
Like, I didn't put it into my relationship. I didn't put it in my housework. I didn't put it into any. I put it into my recovery.
She did.
200%.
She really did. And, you know, I had to say to her over and over in her journey in recovery, which was 18 months at least, right? Over and over, I had to say, I was wrong. I was wrong. I was wrong. Because she just kept proving me wrong, you know, because I was dead set against her at the beginning.
Did you learn something from this experience with Melissa then?
I hope so. I hope so. But I mean, I'm, you know, here I am, but I'm bad to prejudge things, which is ridiculous because I'm a judge and I shouldn't prejudge things, but I'm a human being. And, all I had to go on was her history with me, which was terrible. But yeah, I mean, I think what I've learned is that hope springs eternal, and I need to let people's pasts be in the past and judge them by what they're doing in the moment. And in the moment, she shined. I mean, she came to life. She wound up just being a delightful person. I ended up really just growing to love her, consider her a friend. She just demonstrated the resilience of a human being, and the fact that we can't afford to judge people on their pasts. We have to look at what they're doing right now. And the redemption that Melissa got, and the fact that she went through a recovery and has been clean for how long?
It'll be 23 months, the 27th of this month.
Is just a beautiful person. She's got a life. She's got a... a career. She's got repairing relationships with family. We watched that happen with her during this process. It's been a joy. And her charges get dismissed today. And there's no reluctance on my part to do that. I just hate for her to be away from us.
I'll miss y'all too. But I'll still be around. Not in the courtroom though.
Good. Good.
A familiar experience for rural people is that you know many of your neighbors. You also know that some of your neighbors are doing fine and others aren't. And when you grow up knowing who's doing fine and who's not, you learn to be part of all of it. In a city, you have choices in grocery stores, doctor's offices, recreation spaces, where you can be insulated from drug culture. But in rural and small town places, there might be only one doctor, a couple gas stations, a grocery store, and one school. You can't take a break from drug culture because it's always right beside you. Here's a conversation I had with Jessica. Jessica grew up here and knows what it's like as a kid when you don't feel accepted at school and drug culture is right outside your door.
Just started following the outcast crowd, the ones that were making bad decisions, and older people that were making bad decisions because they didn't pass judgment and they let you do whatever you wanted to do. I continued drinking, and then I started smoking pot when I was about 12. That older crowd, they're just getting their license, or they're just... they're hanging out on the corner at the park, you know, behind the scenes in the shadows. And I'm like, oh, what are they doing? You know, and they're kind of dressed like I am. And they come from the poor families, and you hear about other people talk about them. So you're like, okay, well, maybe that's for me. And like I said, they don't pass judgment and they just take you right on into their flock and you just become a part of something, anything at that point. So yeah.
Was that good for you? A good feeling?
It was a good feeling. It felt like I belonged to something. It felt like I was a part of something. I guess that is what family would feel like. So going on from there, I started hanging out with the really older crowd. And by 13, I had done used meth, it was crank and cocaine, like on a regular basis.
I also heard about the drug dealing side of drug culture from DJ. DJ grew up helping his family sell drugs when he was a kid. Here he is describing getting caught when he was 13 years old and his little brother was 11.
We got busted on Main Street when I was 13. We was selling a lot of crack cocaine. Right where that the barbecue spot is at, it was a Puerto Rican restaurant. and we was cool with them. We used to like, give them money and just we was cool with them. And they called us and said, "There's fire trucks and ambulances outside." So we didn't think nothing of it. Mm-hmm. And you can look out the window and see the whole Main Street. And we look out the window, it's just the fire. It was ambulances and fire trucks, and wasn't nobody getting out of them. And then she called back again, and she said, "There's SWAT jumping out of, there's police jumping out of ambulances down here." So we took off running to the roof. By the time we got on top of my grandma's roof, police was standing on top of the roof, waiting for us to run up here. So they bring me and my little brother downstairs. This time they got like five guns and like 2 ounces of crack cocaine. I was 13, almost 14, and he was 11. And right after that, I went to jail. Yeah, I didn't get out until I was 18 then.
When I first became aware of the impact of drug use in my farming community in Northeast Iowa, I was 11 years old. It was 1981, and one morning during church, a high schooler crashed her car at the intersection between a cornfield and the cemetery. We had literally finished singing the last hymn, and we could hear this distant rumble coming from a car up the road. It got louder, and the church shook until the noise ended in a loud crash. People filled the aisle to go see what happened. When I got outside, I saw Brenda standing in the road. She had a gash above her eye that was bleeding heavily. The front part of her car was wrapped around a yield sign. She was incoherent. She couldn't see what was in front of her because she was so high. That year, there was this big catastrophe headed our way. It was called the farm crisis. In Iowa, it was just beginning to impact our area with farm foreclosures and auctions. Parents were getting jobs in town to try to stay afloat, and kids were doing the heavy chores on the farm by themselves. Food lines began popping up in little towns because farmers didn't have enough to eat. But on the day that I saw Brenda standing in the road like that, it didn't occur to me that maybe what she was doing was because her life was getting difficult at home. In fact, I blamed her for using drugs and crashing her car. I also learned something that day. I watched the grown-ups around me step in quickly to help neighbors who were struggling. They showed me how not to be afraid of tragedy, and they didn't hesitate. They gathered Brenda up and carried her to a car. Somebody wiped blood from her eyes. Her mother, who'd been in church with us, cradled Brenda's head in the back seat, and two guys jumped in the front and drove them to town. In the days and weeks that followed, neighbors dropped off food and helped with the farm. There was a lot of trust and love in their actions. I also know now that the same year that Brenda started using drugs, a banker rolled into their yard and foreclosed on a 500-acre section south of their farm. Brenda's drug use spiraled, and she ran away from home. Her dad's alcohol use grew out of control, and her mother had to go to work in town. In the end, Brenda's drug use had been a symptom of the farm crisis, and within a few years, she became a statistic.
It's just like a revolving door, especially when you're in addiction, because, you know, you go into the system and you never get no help for the underlying addiction. And you go into the system and you're an addict. There's drugs in there too, so you use drugs in there, and then you get thrust right back out into the same situation you was in.
Take a look at what America spends on incarceration. Our annual federal prison budget is over $8.5 billion per year. And our state's combined budget for incarceration is around $64 billion per year. One in five of these incarcerated people is serving time for drug-related crime. And the escalation in incarceration is directly related to policing drugs in poor communities and neighborhoods that are predominantly African American. Nixon's war on drugs opened the door for decades of a growing prison population. In 1975, 240,000 Americans were in jail. In 2019, there were 1.4 million. And in 2020, more than 5.5 million people combined were serving probation, being monitored, or were incarcerated by the adult correctional systems. That's a lot of Americans. When mom or dad are in jail and not getting treated for addiction, there's no opportunity for them to remain in the workforce and with their families. Here in Southwest Virginia, a rural part of the state, we have the highest incarceration rates per capita. Some communities are missing up to 6% of their population because they're in jail. Here are some stories from participants of the Recovery Court program who shared a small portion of their experiences with incarceration and the legal system. You will hear first the voice of Anna.
I really had a good job. I was a mental health worker and got strung out on heroin, pills, and meth and lost everything. I felt like I got kicked out. I was like renting places. I got kicked out of my rentals, had evictions. Cars getting repoed. I lost my youngest daughter when she was 13 to DSS. I just lost everybody and everything. I got pulled over in March 2020, and I got in trouble for possession of methamphetamines. And I was given first offenders or whatever, and I only went one time to see my probation officer, paid no fines, no community service, because I didn't want to change. All I wanted to do was chase that first high that I would never get again. So I didn't do what I was supposed to. I spent 15 months on the run. I end up violating, go to jail, get out. I violate two more times. And I was homeless, living out of trash bags, had tubs carrying them around. I just really went through a lot. And I just determined, like, the beginning of 2023 that that's not the lifestyle I wanted to live anymore. I was tired. I was done. I was burnt out. I couldn't do it anymore. So instead of pulling my 65% of my good time in jail, I was approved for drug court, which has been a blessing, a recovery court, should I say. It's been a blessing because it has turned my life around completely. Like, it has changed. Like, I was given the opportunity to prove myself, and I am 1 year and 5 days clean and sober today.
Here's Casey.
I started using methamphetamines. It's just a horrible drug. It will take everything from you. And I got into trouble, and I ended up in jail for roughly 4 years. I had to give custody of my son to his dad, and then I went to jail at the age of 34. I got out around before I turned 40, and I hit the ground running, and I was like, I'm going to do good, and this is all, you know, because I'm not a kid anymore, but it wasn't long. I got out in January of 19, and by September of 19, I was in trouble again. It was during COVID, so they postponed those charges for several years, and I had my daughter. So after I had her, then they come back with these charges, and they offered me 5 years and 6 months in jail or the recovery program. So I just decided I cannot do this anymore, and so I took my daughter to social services and asked them to help me with her so that I could start the recovery program and make sure, you know, that I could get myself straight and do the program. They took her in for 6 months. And in the year I got her back. I also went to court for my son because I wanted him to know that he was just as important as she was.
So did you get custody back of both kids?
I have full custody back of my daughter and my son. His dad still has custody, but he comes every single week.
And here's Eric.
I think the inmates you got to worry about most of the time is the guards. They're their own gang. I mean, for the most part, you got some good ones. But if you're doing something they don't like, you give them any kind of mouth or anything like that, they will retaliate.
Yeah.
They will retaliate. They will plant knives on you. I've watched them turn dogs loose on people. I've watched them, you know, especially in like in Virginia system at Wallander Ridge, they might as well have been KKK up there. They're racist.
I want to talk for a second about people who have wealth and privilege and access versus people who don't.
If you get a court appointed lawyer, they're going to give you who they want But if a man can go out and pay for his lawyer, he definitely will get, most of the time, a lesser sentence, if a sentence at all. For example, I'm in recovery court for selling three Suboxone. I know a guy who is a convicted felon who got caught with almost 20-some guns, like 4 pounds of weed, meth, almost $5,000. And because he could hire his own lawyer, he didn't do a day. So I know for a fact he gave like $25,000 to this lawyer. So how did he get out of it? How did he not do no time?
And lastly, this is DJ.
When you get sentenced in the feds, they want to know your childhood. They send you downstairs. Literally, this is how it goes. They bring you to the courthouse. They send you downstairs in the basement, and they got somebody that asks you questions about your childhood. It's called the pre-sentencing. And they ask you about your whole childhood, mama, daddy, brother, sister, all this. And then when you tell them your story and what you've been through, nothing changes. So I don't even know why they won't even know it. Why do they want to know that your mama been smoking crack since she was 25 and your daddy did 27 years in jail, left you on the street, and you had to hustle? My mama taught me how to cook crack when I was 11 years old. What was the reason for them wanting to know that? Like, it didn't help my sentence at all. I got an upper variance in my sentence. You can get in the feds, you get a lower variance, meaning they give you less time, or they give you more time. I told them my story, they gave me more time.
For about 20 years, there's been an emerging study of how experiences called positive and adverse childhood events impact our health, well-being, and behaviors in adulthood. The Daily Yonder points to this study in Home Cooked, our podcast series about meth use in rural America. You should check it out. Positive and adverse childhood events is a body of research that predicts that the number of adverse childhood events can be quantified, turned into a number. It's called the ACE quiz, and an individual's results are called an ACE score. But what does this have to do with rural and small town people caught up in drug culture? Dr. Karen Darafenko at the University of Tennessee Health Sciences Center is the first to lead a study connecting ACE scores to the vulnerability of drug relapse in rural communities. She brought her research to a rural opioid clinic in Tennessee, and 87 people participated. Nearly 50% of the people in the study had an ACE score of 4 or more. Scoring a 4 or higher is a lot. Nationwide, only 16% have a 4. Darafenko's research is in early stages, but the results of this first study are stunning. If 50% of a group of people who are being treated at a rural opioid clinic have a high ACE score, it means that their adverse childhood events have had a direct impact on their substance use activity and subsequent addiction. Dr. Darafenko's study also showed that drug relapse increases for every point of an individual's ACE score by 17%. This means that for someone in a rural community who is addicted to drugs or alcohol and has an ACE score of 4, that they have a 68% chance of relapse. In other words, 32% chance of staying clean. It also suggests that your success at achieving long-term sobriety is possible if you are willing to examine your childhood history and take therapeutic and intentional steps to heal. Adverse childhood events are a common thread with everyone I talk to in recovery court. Some grew up in homes where drug dealing was normal. It's common to hear that alcohol and drug use is prevalent. Others lived in households where both parents were working several jobs just to make ends meet, which left the kids to fend for themselves. And some households were violent, or paddling was a frequent practice.
My dad was a drug dealer, and so he, set us down and told us, you know, if they ask you about these things, you know, we do have them in our home, but if you tell them, they'll take me away. And then when I was 15, my dad, he just kind of set me down and was like, you know, I know that you're going to do drugs, so I want you to come to me if you're going to do them so that I know what you're doing is safe. So I tried cocaine and crank at 15.
Yeah, I moved up here whenever my dad ended up getting that life sentence when I was like 10. My dad went to jail. We moved in with my mom and her mom for a little bit, and then my mom's mom died. So we had nowhere to go, so we had to move up here.
I was more or less being groomed at this point because the people I was running around with were drug dealers. And there was an older man that was good to me. And we'll say that. He was good to me. In the same sense, I was a child. He was about 18 years older than me. I felt like something, somebody. What actually was taking place, I feel like, was I was being groomed to become a part of the drug industry.
There was a lot of things that happened to me in my childhood that, you know, I had good parents. And they tried, but there was alcohol involved in a lot of my family affairs, my whole family. Along with that, you know, when you got people drinking and stuff like that, violence comes a lot of the time.
Early histories with incarceration or racism, being poor, or having a lack of access and exposure to mainstream and sober cultures, all of these things impact an ability to recover from addiction or get away from drug culture. What's happening in recovery court here in Southwest Virginia reminds me of how my community responded to Brenda back in 1981 when she crashed her car in front of the church. Just like my neighbors did back then, recovery court is showing how people from a safe community go to the place where people are struggling with hard times or addiction and show support by helping out. And in these interviews with people going through recovery court, you can hear for yourself how some are feeling welcomed for the first time in their lives.
Recovery court is a great program. I wasn't used to having people that could be there for me to help me. Like they truly, you know, if you need them, they're there for you.
What do you look forward to in your future?
Look forward to my son seeing that it is possible that you make mistakes and that you can regain yourself and things and be better. I look forward to raising my daughter, and I am just excited about when I very first got sober, I will never forget thinking, I don't belong. Like, I didn't feel like I fit in, because it had been so many years. You know, if you think of 15 until you're 40, I didn't know what straight was. I make a joke to my friends all the time. I don't even know how I like my eggs, because, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know who I am. I didn't know anything about myself. But I'm learning daily I'm learning throughout what it's like or who I am. But it's a big eye-opener when you get straight, and it's been that many years. You've been your whole life. Like, I remember walking around like, I don't belong here. But it's way better on this side of things.
And here's Mary Ann.
Recovery court has taught me that there are people in this world who do care about addicts and sees addicts differently than a lot of the other ones in this world do. It gave me a second chance and to realize and finally see who I was. They see you differently, and not only do you get to learn about them, but they learn about me as well on a completely different level. You know, it's just like the workout class on Thursday nights that we have. We work out with the Commonwealth attorney. We work out with the two judges. You know, when you walk in a courtroom, they only see you with those charges that you have. They don't know who you are. You know, this workout program that we have with them, we sit down, we talk, we pray. they get to know you and we get to know them on a completely different level. We become friends, you know what I mean? And that means so much. And if you do good, or even if you do bad, they still lift you up.
Yeah.
You know, because they want to see you do good and succeed in this life.
Yeah. And Eric.
I'm not going to sit here and lie. You know, I hated the law. I hated them. I hated the judges and everybody. But the judges in this county, I didn't think they cared. I thought it was just, you know, they were out to get us. Anybody who was a low life or was into drugs or whatever. So I turned that hate towards them, you know, like, but since I've been in this program, you know, these judges that work out with us, I've talked to them on a daily basis. They're not bad people, man. And they're really trying to help. They're really trying to do something good, I feel. And, you know, this, in a lot of ways, I needed this, and I just wished it had been done years ago, because I think I would have got out of this system, this never-ending revolving door of going to prison, coming back out, still in addiction, if these type of programs would have been offered back then, you know, instead of that hard-nosed, throw them in jail type of, you know, attitude towards things. It's really brought me around to law enforcement and everything. I know they got a tough job. And I look at them different now that I see the judges coming and doing workouts with us. I see them cheering us on when something good happens in our life.
And finally, here's Anna.
When I was in addiction, I would isolate myself. I never went outside the house. I never done anything unless I had to. I would stay inside all the time. And I'm really excited about spring coming up, because things that I used to enjoy doing, I never done during addiction. So I feel like I can go enjoy those things and not associate it with. Like, I like doing outside sports. I like fishing. I just like outside at all. Just like little things. Like, I love the sky. Like, I can wake up in the mornings now and I see daylight and I'm excited. When before, I'm just like, oh, well, you know, the sky is so pretty. It's beautiful. Like I said, everything used to irritate me. It's just like now I enjoy everything about life and God's creation. When before, everything bothered me. Just being alive bothered me, really. Like, I'm seeing a side of me that I've not seen in a long time, like since I was a small child. I've gained so much back in sobriety. You know what I'm saying? Like, my oldest daughter, she's like, didn't even want me around. But now I have a 13-month-old granddaughter that I get to babysit by myself. A 9-year-old grandson stays with me every weekend. Like, my daughter, we have a great relationship now. Like, yeah. Everything that I lost, I have regained. I can only start over and do better day by day. I can't make up for anything, but I can be a better person. I look forward to each and every day. Absolutely. Like, I can't wait to, I love to sleep and eat now. Like, I want to go to bed and I want to eat all the time. And I can't wait to get up in the mornings.
What's important to me about these recordings is that these are my neighbors and friends. They are also experts from the front lines of rural America's struggle with addiction and drug culture. Most often, journalism covers the perspectives of researchers, law enforcement, and leadership on these issues. But I wanted to make sure that we also hear from the people going through this. I did these recordings because I believe we need leadership from people who've lived it. We need their voices to help the rest of us understand what's happened to them. And these people deserve a place at the decision-making table that shapes policy affecting policing and substance use. People living with addiction and in recovery should also be a part of the conversation about the best therapies and treatments. Through all of these conversations, the biggest takeaway for me was that each of these people began their drug and alcohol use in childhood. When an addictive activity begins in childhood, how can we expect adults with these histories to just get over it and get jobs? Listening to this group tell their life stories, you hear voices of people who've had so many strikes against them. But something really stands out, too. With the help of programs like Recovery Court and Recovery Fitness, they've found a community that seems to help them persevere and build resilience. Mary Ann told me the other day that her well water is now full of red clay, but she can't afford to have a new well put in. While that's been a major setback in her life, she still goes to work, and she hasn't missed any of her recovery court responsibilities. And Mary Ann isn't the only one coping with major life setbacks during this program. Many in this group are rolling with considerable difficulties. And despite everything, they persevere. They're survivors. We have a lot to learn from people who are going through cycles of addiction, incarceration, and drug culture. Remember that whatever mistakes that a person has made to end up in those circumstances, it's because of scores of strikes against them that got them there. But it only takes another single chance to get them back on their feet, and you might be their chance. What you have heard here are just segments of these interviews. Please listen to these full recordings on the Daily Yonders website, linked in the description of this episode. You'll definitely hear something in them that will help you to help someone else. Linked in the show notes, you can also find the series I wrote for the Daily Yonder last year. This series is all about Judges Geisler and Harrell and Walter Midkiff, the innovator of recovery fitness and its integration with the Recovery Court program in Southwest Virginia.
I want people in this community to realize that addiction is a disease. It's not something that people choose. Yes, we choose to do a drug, maybe. Some people are forced to do those drugs. You never know what's going on in somebody's life. If a person sees somebody struggling, lend a helping hand, try to talk to that person. Don't judge a person by its cover, because you just don't know.
This episode was produced and written by Sarah June Josebo and produced and edited by Susanna Brown. Our executive producer is Joel Cohen. Thank you to the staff of the Daily Yonder and the Rural Assembly. Special thanks to the participants and organizers of Galax County Recovery Court for sharing their stories.
On the Rebound, Stories from Recovery Court is an Eastern Standard special presentation in partnership with the Rural Remix podcast series from the Daily Yonder. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out our archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, Buzzsprout, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.